From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula.
Welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host for this week, Junie Kim. With North Korea becoming an increasingly dangerous threat to the U.S. and its allies, it can be all too easy to overlook North Korea's origins and how its foreign policy first took shape. One of the less-known aspects of North Korea's foreign policy was its heavy involvement in supporting non-state actors and rebel movements in Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia. Benjamin Young, a PhD candidate in East Asian history at George Washington University, recently presented his paper on North Korea's support of non-state actors as part of KEI's academic paper series. He sat down with me to discuss how North Korea's first leader, Kim Il-sung's experiences in guerrilla warfare shaped his foreign policy and what his legacy means for North Korea today. Enjoy. Well, thank you, Ben, for sitting down with us, and thank you for coming to present at KEI. It was great to listen to you and to hear your presentation.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, and it was great to talk about my research that I'm currently involved in and to have a platform in Washington, D.C. to do so, and especially in the current crisis between North Korea and the U.S. today. I think my research is relatively relevant.
Exactly. Even though your research is historical, I think it has a lot of relevant points to the current crisis. You delve into specifically North Korea's history in supporting non-state actors, which is a very interesting topic that doesn't get a lot of news coverage. We were very concerned about the nuclear program, which obviously makes sense. But it's an interesting aspect of the North Korean regime through three generations, both the founder Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and then the grandson Kim Jong-un. So to start off, in your paper, you state the North Korean Revolution with Kim Il-sung at its core was built on the ethos of the guerrilla fighter. Could you talk more about Kim Il-sung's guerrilla background and how that affected North Korea's foreign policy under his rule?
Yeah, so I come from the view that one's childhood and where one is brought up has a huge influence on their later personal development, and that goes for dictators as well. And I think Kim Il-sung's childhood, growing up fighting Japanese colonialists in the mountains of Manchuria, had a huge effect on his view later in life, and that he essentially used this background as a guerrilla fighter to inform his government policy-making decisions, and that's same for the people that surrounded him. So I'm not the first one to come up with this theme of the guerrilla state. Wada Haruki was really the first one, and then it was used by other scholars as well, such as Australian scholar Adrian Bouzeau. And also there was a recent book by Hunuk Kwan about the theater state, North Korea beyond charismatic politics. And that also talks a little bit about North Korea as a guerrilla state as well. And I think that this is a really important and useful concept to use when you're talking about North Korea, because North Korea, it defies certain ideological parameters. It's not really a Stalinist state anymore, and it's not really far-right state either. It kind of also at the same time uses themes and motifs and their propaganda from both pictures, from both polar opposite sides of the ideological spectrum. And so I think a guerrilla state, which doesn't have the ideological baggage of the term Stalinism or far-right or fascism does. So I think, and I think it is a guerrilla state. It thrives on being deceptive and on being unpredictable. But at the same time, a guerrilla is rational. It knows what its intentions is. It knows what its goals is. And it thinks in the long-term future and not in the short-term all the time. You can think of the Viet Cong, that their struggle was in the long-term future. It started with the French and then later it was the Americans. But they saw their future not in terms of four-year or eight-term spans like us Americans do due to our elections, but they think in the long-term future. And I think when it comes to North Korea, they kind of use the same view.
So you use this term in your paper, guerrilla internationalism. Do you mind taking a minute to define what that is and how that has come across in North Korea's foreign policy under Kim Il-sung and the decades after?
Sure. Yeah, so guerrilla internationalism is a term I came up with because I want to use the guerrilla state framework, but I also want to put my own spin on it, because usually the guerrilla state framework has been primarily used when it comes to domestic policy, but I also think it informs North Korea's foreign policy in terms of Kim Il-sung and also Kim Jong-il. They assisted guerrilla movements around the world, and they saw this as being part of this anti-colonial global struggle. And I think maybe to us Westerners or us growing up in the capitalist world, we tend to kind of prioritize economic interactions, tit-for-tat exchange, but ideology has always been very important to the regime in North Korea, and they haven't always thought in terms of purely economic exchanges. That's a relatively new phenomenon just because of their conditions. But for example, North Korea, they used to provide funds to developing African countries. They would build irrigation systems, sewage systems, buildings, palaces for African governments, and they would receive very little, if anything, in return. And so if you think of North Korea as an aid giver, that's very different from today when you think of North Korea as an aid recipient. So I think that there is some historical continuities when it comes to North Korea's third world policy, but also historical major shifts as well.
Yeah, it was really interesting because I think when we think about North Korea nowadays, we think of it as a very isolated state. But as you talked about, they were very involved in helping out other countries with their own to support this guerrilla internationalism, as you said. And in part of that, you mentioned this at times contradictory nature of their foreign policy, where it simultaneously tried to establish diplomatic relations with third world countries while also supporting rebel groups that were trying to overthrow the government in those same countries. Could you explain kind of the logic and why this contradiction came about from the North Korean perspective?
So I think this was kind of trying to win no matter what. So they did this in the country of Chad in the late 1960s, is that they were aiding anti-government rebels in the African country of Chad at the same time as trying to establish diplomatic relations with that country. And that might seem ridiculous, right? But you have to think that during this process, African governments were not stable for the most part. And that can be said for Chad in this specific incident. And so I think the North Koreans, they tried to like covertly supply these non-state actors, because they knew that African governments weren't stable, but they tried to establish relations at the same time just in case the governments did stay in power. So it may seem contradictory and really just greedy, but I think to the North Koreans, they thought this made perfect sense. But it rarely worked out in their favor because governments quickly took wind of the fact that North Korea was supplying rebels and they didn't want anything to do with them. This happened in Ethiopia. So North Koreans, they were supporting Somalian insurgents and also Eritrean separatists. And Addis Ababa, the government of Addis Ababa, was like, what are you doing, North Korea? This is going against what we're trying to do right now, establish diplomatic relations. North Korea denied that they were supporting these groups. And Addis Ababa essentially kicked them to the side. And it was only until later when Mengistu, the communist leader of Ethiopia, really became close to North Korea.
So you had mentioned earlier that your experiences as you grew up really reflect how you approach your mindset in later life. So Kim Il-sung was very involved in the guerrilla movement against the Japanese occupiers in his time. But his son, Kim Jong-il, had a very posh life, so to say. And so the same thing goes with the grandson, Kim Jong-un. So can you talk about this guerrilla internationalism policy and how it transitioned from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il and now to the grandson, Kim Jong-un?
Great question. When it comes to the guerrilla policy, Kim, as you said, Kim Jong-il was raised in a posh lifestyle. He wasn't a guerrilla fighter. And his body, even if you look at the guy, he doesn't look like a fighter at all. He was soft. But what he did do, he was a masterful propagandist, and he used the anti-Japanese guerrilla tradition as a way to really trace the lineage of the North Korean Revolution back to 1930s Manchuria. And this pleased a lot of the aging guerrillas around Kim Il-sung, and it paved the way to his succession. So we don't really know a lot about the succession from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il. Some people thought that Kim Il-sung from the first day that he became leader, he was going to hand power to one of his sons. I actually don't think that's the case. I think Kim Jong-il actually wrestled power away from a lot of contenders within the inner circle. But I think when North Korea, hopefully when the regime finally collapses one day and the documents are open, we'll learn more about this succession, because it's very important for understanding North Korean history, because if there was no succession, there wouldn't be any Kim Jong-un today, and there probably wouldn't be a DPRK today. It wouldn't have survived the fall of the communist bloc. But I think Kim Jong-il, what he kind of made up for his lack of physical stature in terms of being a brilliant mind and a brilliant propagandist. And so he really manipulated the guerrilla tradition to fit into his need for power. And that's how he essentially became the next ruler of North Korea.
Yeah, you brought up this interesting point too with the succession of Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un, and that I think in Western media we think of the Kim dynasty as all powerful, and that each one of these individuals had all the power. But I think in each instance, like even from Kim Il-sung, he had to purge certain sections of the government in order for him to consolidate power. And you mentioned the same thing maybe happened with Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un, and the fact that he purged his own uncle and likely ordered the assassination of his half-brother. I think behind the scenes, like you said, when we have all the records out there, it's probably a lot more Game of Thrones-like.
Yeah,
behind the
I
scenes.
Agree. Yeah, definitely.
Think.
Yeah, definitely more Game of Thrones. Yeah, but I don't think it was a seamless transition, as we're kind of taught to believe. And there are some documents from former Eastern Bloc countries, such as Hungary and Romania, that kind of, during my dissertation research, they kind of hint that there was some trouble brewing underneath. But even for these diplomats of allied countries based in Pyongyang, they still couldn't really tell what was going on in the inner circle. They had to sometimes look at propaganda, new propaganda ads, and what was happening at museums in Pyongyang. So they even had to read the tea leaves, so to speak. But I think the only way we'll really be able to figure this out is when the regime finally collapses or ceases to exist.
To circle back on the concept of North Korea supporting non-state actors, for the present day, a lot of people are worried about weapons proliferation. And as North Korea's weapons and nuclear programs continue to develop, that becomes just a more deeper concern for a lot of people. So currently, what do you think, what threat does North Korea pose in weapons proliferation of providing WMD technology, not only to other non-state actors, but also rogue states as well? And if it does pose a great threat, what can be done to prevent further proliferation?
Yeah, so I don't actually believe that they would most likely sell nuclear missiles to non-state actors or even foreign governments like Iran. They would be much more likely to sell chemical weapons or, as they've done in the past, arms. The reason being is that in my paper, I outline three primary reasons. One is that the international climate has changed. North Korea is aware that association with like Islamic jihadist groups like Boko Haram and ISIS, they will, if they align themselves with them and it's discovered that North Korea sold weapons to this country, traditional allies like China and Russia, they're going to most likely decide that North Korea has crossed the line and break off vital economic ties for Kim Jong-un's regime. And these two countries, China and Russia, they've been the longstanding allies, kind of begrudgingly, but still allies nonetheless. And they have Islamic insurgent problems of their own in the countries. In Russia's Dagestan and Chechnya, and China's Xinjiang. So they understand the problem that is radical Islamic terrorism. And they would not want North Korea getting involved in this business. And also the other two factors are that groups, some of these non-state actors, like some Kurdish groups, they don't want to buy weapons from North Korea because they still want to, they're seeking international sympathy and attention for their cause. And they know that this could derail that legitimacy-seeking campaign. And third is that Kim Jong-un, he's different from his father, and he has more power than Kim Jong-il had in terms of international power. He has nuclear weapons. They're effectively a nuclear state. And he doesn't have to rely on this kind of third-world solidarity, third-world public diplomacy campaign. And I think he's young, and I think he's really looking into the long-term future of provoking and maybe even trying to reunify the two countries. And I think the only thing that really could hold Kim Jong-un back from being more provocative is his health, to be totally honest with you. I think, you know, he's severely obese. He essentially waddles. And I think and he smokes, he's a chain smoker, he's all smoking. The North Korea, the situation could really change overnight. Kim Jong-un could simply keel over from a heart attack, or there could be a natural disaster, such as an earthquake or the volcano. The Mount Paektu is actually an active volcano, or even some sort of epidemic in North Korea that they're not prepared for. And I think that is something that does worry the regime in Pyongyang, and that's one of the reasons why they may have closed borders during the Ebola crisis. And you would think, like, why would they close the borders over Ebola? That was primarily happening in West Africa. But I think they understand that they have a weak link here in terms of their overall power. And that, you know, something like that is more likely to bring down the regime than a war or what Trump called a military option. And you can't prepare for these things, and you also can't do a whole lot to promote it. You don't want to cause, like, you know, a natural disaster, because there's millions of people that could be put at stake there. And North Korean lives are as valuable as anybody else's lives. They are people. They have their own thoughts and feelings. They grew up in a very brutal and oppressive system. But a North Korean life is of equal value to anybody else's life. So I think we need to keep that in mind as well.
Experts here in D.C. and internationally have been furiously trying to figure out a solution to this North Korean crisis, but you're right, just sheer happenstance might unfold the situation in ways that we don't predict at all.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think that during our lifetimes, the regime, something will finally happen, and it'll cease to exist. I don't want to say it collapse. But something will happen, but it's not going to be, I don't think, within 5, 10, maybe even 20 years. People thought the regime was going to collapse in 1984 when Kim Il-sung died. So the regime, it's a machine, it's a political machine. It keeps on running no matter who's at the helm. But essentially, I think they'll be confronted with a problem that they can't fix, and it'll cause instability internally. And when that does happen, I think the international community needs to be ready and be ready to help the North Korean people. Because when it's all said and done, we're going to discover that that regime did deplorable things that not even Khmer Rouge did during their short-lived reign in Cambodia. I think it's going to be really dire, and I think it's going to be up to the international community, from historians to policy analysts to humanitarian groups to aid groups, to doctors, doctors across borders, that kind of thing. I think they need to be prepared for something to happen in North Korea.
Well, we've had a very interesting discussion. Do you have any other closing thoughts for our listeners?
I think that when it comes to North Korea, we need to understand at the end of the day that there are people there, and that they, I know that's kind of a cliche, so to speak, but when Trump is talking about the military option, and he's talking about being aggressive, and that he may or may not start a war, there are millions of lives at stake, and their lives are the same value as anybody else's life. And I think that's something we need to consider when we make policy-making decisions overall.
Great. Well, thank you once again, Ben, for coming in and
thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh,
this
no
is
worries.
My first podcast, so hopefully it wasn't too awkward.
And most likely not your last as well.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. As always, please subscribe and like our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you here again next week for another episode.